The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
The most populated country in Africa is on the brink of a security crisis, with more Christians murdered for their faith in Nigeria than in any other country in the world. Many fear for their lives. Nigeria is the ninth on the world watch list. Christians make up almost 50% of the population, and yet many have been killed. Schools have been shut down, schools have been burnt down, teachers have been killed, even recently in the last month. What is happening to Christians in Nigeria?
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
I'm actually stunned. If you think about the number, 17 Nigerian Christians were killed every day for the first few months of this year, for 2021. Think about how many that is a month, let alone how those months add up. That audio you heard came from, there was a webinar hosted by the Aid to the Church in Need, and they had respective speakers that addressed the audience, a bishop, several priests from Nigeria. They all confirmed one thing, and that's that violence has been plaguing the country for the past several years, and it's not due to farming land clashes. It's over religious persecution. They claim it's religious persecution in action. 17 Nigerian Christians killed every day. You live in the United States of America. You have an inalienable right to life, to liberty, to the pursuit of happiness, right? You have the ability to worship freely in this country. You're not worried about being brutally raped and murdered and tortured and killed, being persecuted for your faith. Imagine being a follower of Christ and truly believing in your faith and having to live in a country where 17 Christians every day are killed. I mean, that's crazy. That is just crazy. There continue to be stories around the country of people who are losing their jobs, either because their conscience is not going to allow them to get the vaccine against COVID-19, or because they won't call a boy a girl and a girl a boy, or they won't go along performing some sort of medical procedure like an abortion or distributing contraception or prescribing legal some sort of lethal drug for assisted suicide. Those things, aren't causing people to lose their lives. They are a real witness. The word martyrdom, is really, it means in English for the truth. They're dying for the truth. People are losing their jobs for the truth. There are all kinds of Christians around the world who are taking the ultimate and making the ultimate sacrifice, and that is laying their life down for their belief that Jesus Christ is Lord, that they were created to live forever, that there is an eternity, that there is a heaven. And they are witnessing to the truth of Jesus Christ, and they're dying because of it. In Afghanistan, where the U.S. government has abandoned its own citizens, as well as many of the Afghans who helped our troops over the past two decades during time of war, Christians today are being killed on the spot. Nobody talks about this. And that's why I want to use this platform just to, if you can't do anything, pray for them, sacrifice for them, call your elected officials, support organizations that are helping them. It's Afghanistan. What a mess, right? On so many levels, just so many levels. But to be a Christian there, to come up against the Taliban, when they find a Christian, they give you a chance. So say they identify you as a Christian. They come to your house, your business, wherever it is. You can deny Christ, right? Or you can accept Christ. You can testify to him. You can reject him. You can be an apostate. Or you can say, no, I'm a Christian. And if you say, no, I'm a follower of Jesus Christ, they'll give you a chance to convert, right? You can convert, or maybe if you're a Muslim, reconvert to Islam. If you say, no, I can't do that, that's not the true faith, you are killed right there in front of your family. And I'm not making that up. That has happened and is happening over and over again. That's Afghanistan. Nigeria, there's a long-standing conflict between Muslims and Christians, where primarily Muslims have been raiding Christian lands. They've been putting people to death. It's been portrayed as being about grazing lands for cattle. But the bishop, Bishop Wilfred, I think his name is Anigby. He's from the a diocese there. I was reading something he said earlier. He says, if this was about grazing, why kill people, right? Just why burn their homes? Just take the land, right? No, it's not about grazing. It's about Islamicizing the nation. That's what it's about. It's what he called a slow genocide of Christians. This is going on today. It's going on today. You need to be aware of it. In Uganda, I'll give you another example. Muslims buried a man who converted to Christianity, but he wasn't dead. They buried the man alive. What a horrific death. Imagine being alive, being bound and buried alive. Pakistan. Christian girls there. I always want to be careful about what I say because I don't want to be too graphic. They're taken at gunpoint in broad daylight. If you're a Christian family, I have three sons and two daughters, right? They'd come to my house and they would take my daughters away as sex slaves. They take your daughters as sex slaves. And the police, they don't do anything about it. That is going on today. I'm joined right now by Eric Patterson. He's the executive vice president of the Religious Freedom Institute. And I would encourage you, if you want to learn more about this, if you want to see the scope of what's unfolding today, and you want to know how to help, check out religiousfreedominstitute.org. It's religiousfreedominstitute.org. Eric's been with me in the past. It's always good to talk with him. Eric, thank you for returning. Good afternoon.
Drew, good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Well, those are just a few of the cases. I mean, I could probably give a litany more, but you know, the media, I was struck by what happened in Afghanistan. They kind of went radio silent very quickly after the airport debacle. Give us a picture. What's happening in Afghanistan right now? What's happening there to the Christians especially?
Yeah. Truth, thank you for asking about this, and it's a great opportunity for us to not only be updated, but to remind ourselves of the types of prayers that need to happen there for Afghanistan. What's seized the news over the last few days was the attack by ISIS, ISIS-K, who's actually at the odds with the Taliban government. They attacked a minority Shia mosque, and killed over 40 people. And so one dynamic there is that there's 3 to 5 million ethnic Hazaras who are largely Shia or the minority Islamic religion. They are under assault. There's been attacks on them across the country, just like bad in the bad old Taliban days. When it comes to Christians, I think there's a couple of things to think about here. One is that there are still some Christian relief workers on the ground trying to help in Afghanistan. And those are people that we need to be praying for them and for their organizations. It's a small number at this point. Second, no one's sure right now what the numbers are. Before the Taliban took over, maybe as many as 18,000, maybe 15,000 Christians, all converts to Christianity there in Afghanistan. And of course, they are in a dire situation with essentially no guaranteed political or human rights. They can be attacked at any time. And because they are all Christian converts from Islam, every single one of them can be seen as an apostate or a blasphemer, depending on whose interpretation of the law they have, which makes them eligible for the death penalty.
Yeah, well, frightening reality for a lot of followers of Christ. I often wonder, what would you do if you're there, you know, in front of your wife, your children, or you had to make that decision? It's really a heroic time for many of these people. And gosh, we need their prayers and we need to help them. How can we help? I think about that sometimes. We could talk Nigeria, South Sudan. There's lots of other places going on. But you hear these stories. What can the average person who's listening do? I mean, how do you make a difference?
It's very hard. I do think that groups that you've talked about, like Aid to the Church in Need and others, our own organization, Open Doors, et cetera, have a key role to play in testifying and bringing together evidence from all of these cases and putting it before government authorities in the West so that governments like the current U.S. government or the U.K. government don't fall over themselves to cut deals with these terrible governments and give them financial aid that would support them. I think that that's one common sense thing that citizens can do is to tell their elected legislators, we don't support this. If these rogue regimes continue to massacre Christians and other religious minorities, do not cut deals with them. We need stronger Christian voices on this very matter when it comes to other countries like China and Nigeria and Pakistan as well. So one is giving, one is prayer, and one is, you know, legislators do listen to phone calls and letters that come in, and that is something that every citizen can do. Just a few letters, just a few strong phone calls will actually make a U.S. congressperson or senator listen.
Yeah, to that point, you know, I think about what's going on in Nigeria. It's been going on for 10 years, and yet authorities there haven't done anything to stop it. How many Christians have been killed over there, and what kind of intervention are we seeing from the international community? Now, I've talked about what's happening in China with the Uyghurs in the past. I know there's been some action, some attempted action to try to, you know, have China address that issue. Where's the international community on what's happening here? And like I said, 10 years, a decade in Nigeria, and everybody's turning a blind eye. It's frustrating.
Yeah, the Nigeria situation is just so sad and reprehensible. It's sad because you have a Muslim-majority government led by a conservative Muslim, and Boko Haram, the terrorist group in the north, has killed tens of thousands of fellow Muslim citizens. So you'd think that the administration in the capital, Abuja, would want to crack down vigorously, but they haven't. They've largely looked the other way. And of course, Christians, which are a much smaller minority in the north, are under death threats every day. When it comes to the middle of the country, like you said earlier in the broadcast, last year, it was estimated that over 4,000 Christians were killed by Muslims in Nigeria, many, many of them in the middle belt or the middle region of the country, and under 100 Muslims were killed by Christians in retaliatory or direct violence of that nature. So it seems like there's just a bullseye on the back of pastors, priests, seminarians, some aid workers in that part of the country. Now, there's some other complicated dynamics. I don't want to take away from any of those complicated dynamics. Right. But the numbers don't lie. And what I think that in the practical political realm, the only thing that's going to push the Nigerian government to take action is not only Western governments, but also Muslim-majority governments to say, listen, tens of thousands of both Christians and Muslims are being killed. You're destabilizing an entire region. That's not good for any of us. We don't want ISIS, Boko Haram, and Al-Qaeda elements crossing our borders like they're doing throughout West Africa. This has got to stop. That's how to get at this.
Wow. All right, my guest today is Eric Patterson. If you want to join us, our number here, 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Hey, Eric, Roseanne in Green Bay has got a question, or at least a comment for you, I think. Roseanne, hi, you're on the air with Eric. Go right ahead.
Hello? Yes, I read the book, The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch by David Pinault. I think you also mentioned it before sometimes, so I got the name.
Sure.
We read the book.
Yep.
Yeah. And this is very important because I learned a lot about what Islam is. So, and then it so happened that on the 8th of October is the Feast of Our Lady of Good Remedy. It's already in the year 1000, we were doing what we are doing now, trying to save all the Christians from the Islamic taken over. And so we formed a group now of women here in Green Bay that every 8th of the month, we're going to pray for the conversion of Islam. There is no other way but to get together if not through a total conversion. It's impossible. Islamic cannot change. This happened from the year 621.
Right. Well, Roseanne, I love what you're doing. Let me hold you on that point because I only have a couple minutes here with Eric. And you heard what she did. They formed a group and they are praying for Islam and for its conversion, and especially for these people who are perpetrating such hatred and evil on others. Your thoughts, Eric?
Well, I applaud you likewise for bringing a group of people together to pray and to study in order to learn as much as possible so that we can have informed prayer. And certainly there are not just a few, but unfortunately millions of violent Islamists in the parts of the world that we're talking about, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Nigeria, now attacks into South Sudan, We see ISIS in Mozambique and other parts of the world. And this, there's an element of this that is clearly spiritual warfare, because we know that the enemy wants to kill, steal, and destroy. And so prayer about this is very, very important. And at the same time, when we think about how are we going to act in the political realm, what's the best way to build a coalition to defeat that type of violent Islamism? The United States can't do it alone. It's going to have to do it with partners. Mm-hmm. And we're going to need partners from across cultural and faith traditions to throttle this violence. We need to always, though, call it what it is. It's killing human beings. It's breaking a covenant, a human rights covenant, that people are the children of God and that they shouldn't be slain, massacred extrajudicially for these purposes.
All right, let's grab another call for you. Yvonne is listening in Whittier, California. Yvonne, welcome. You're on the air with Eric Patterson.
Hi, Drew. I heard you say, I'm not sure if it was Eric or Drew, that all of a sudden we hear nothing about what's going on in Afghanistan. There's like media silence. But I have been wondering for months, what is happening in Cuba? The same kind of situation. We saw hundreds of people in the streets uprising, and then all of a sudden, nothing. I haven't heard anything for months, not one peep. Do you know what's going on there? Does anyone know?
Eric, I'm assuming you're following that as well as the Middle East. So what's happening in Cuba?
Yeah, that's right. So in the Cuba case, you're exactly right that there was a blip on our screens, in part because people started trying to leave the country, that there were reactions in the streets, that there is a kind of a pro-democracy, pro-religious freedom, pro-human rights movement. And that kind of stumbled along for a bit. It went quiet, a little bit quieter during some of the heat of summer, but it was also repressed. But there are daily small demonstrations going on in parts of Cuba, particularly in urban areas along these lines. And I would say that the situation in Cuba remains quite volatile. There wasn't the kind of massive government crackdown that we've seen in places like Venezuela or, say, in Iran. There is a surge of support for freedom in Cuba right now. And it is led in part by faithful Catholics and evangelicals who are working across religious lines to try to bring a constructive approach to democratization and to religious freedom and to overt Christian witness in Cuba. And that's again, something to pray for.
All right, Yvonne, thank you. Really great to hear from you.
So the people who are supporting them, the Catholics and evangelicals, are here in the U.S.?
Well, some of the leadership is indigenous on the ground. We're talking about priests and evangelical leaders on the ground who are bringing people together, who have been very visible in some of the marches and things that were especially happening in June and July. One of the things that's been going on is that there is a major planned event, a march planned for November. And it's just been in the news today about that the Cuban authorities have been saying, we're not going to allow this march to go forward. Because this is clearly an anti-regime march. So you're really hitting something that's hot off the press, that there's a moment right now where evangelical pastors and Catholic priests are making a public witness for the freedom of all Cubans.
Well, Eric, I want to thank you for your time today. It's great to have you here, and I appreciate what you're doing to raise awareness and help those who are suffering and ultimately dying for their belief in Jesus Christ. If people want to learn more, the best way to go is, the best site to go to is just religiousfreedominstitute.org, or is there something else you want to recommend?
That's exactly right, and we'd love for people to sign up for our newsletters or follow us on Twitter or on Facebook or on Instagram. We're in all those places as well. Drew, thanks for your witness and for your great work.
Well, thank you. Always good to talk to you. That's Eric Patterson. He's Executive Vice President of that organization, the Religious Freedom Institute. Do sign up. Do follow them. It is religiousfreedominstitute.org. We only touched on a few of the countries that this is taking place, but it's real. I know we suffer in our own way here in the States. We have persecution as well. When I come back, I want to talk about another, I don't know what you call it, persecution. It's too strong of a word, but I do want to talk about some censorship that is going on, something that I think will give you some pause. I'm surprised. I'm going to share some audio with you. And if you are frustrated by maybe posting something on YouTube. And, you know, there was a time, there was a period when that was like the Wild West. You know, it was a frontier. It was a transparent glass of water. You could see right through it. And, you know, you could post and do all sorts of things. Now we are seeing the use of algorithms, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or YouTube, when it comes to certain type of speech, it begins to get censored. And I know if you haven't heard much about big tech censorship in the last few weeks, it's not because it's not happening. It's just, you know, making the news as much as everywhere else. But yesterday, there was a major conservative group, called the American Principles Project. They found out that they were kicked off of YouTube. I don't know if you've ever checked them out. Again, that's APP, the American, you know, American Principles Project. They were started by none other than one of the most intelligent men I have the opportunity to talk to, and that's Professor Robert George from Princeton. I mean, the guy is just, he should be sitting on the Supreme Court. And they described itself as a lobbying group for the family, and they claim to be the only national pro-family organization engaging directly in campaign elections. So what happens? That made them the primary target for the opposition. When we come back, I'll share some more with you, because they're not the only ones that have been targeted like this. PragerU has been sued, by big tech for censorship. They put together a 20-minute documentary. I'm going to play some excerpts of it for you coming up here. I think it's telling. I think it's eye-opening. I think this is something you really need to hear. So stay with me. When I come back, I'll get you plugged in.
Connecting you to the truths of your Catholic faith. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
My name is Brian Amridge. I was the senior engineering manager at Facebook. I saw the role that communication technology could have in giving somebody with no power, no money, no connection to the media, a voice and the ability to get their ideas out there in front of other people. And I believed very strongly that the velocity with which a person could do that was sort of a fundamental lever.
I'm Dave Rubin. I'm the host of The Rubin Report, and I'm the co-founder of Locals.com. It's really weird, actually, because, you know, these things are all free, and you can sign up for them in 2 seconds. So it's like, oh, wow, this is awesome. It's the Wild West. We can do whatever we want, whenever we want, and nobody's our boss, and we can come and go as we please. It's all fantastic. And that's sort of the way it was for those first few years of YouTube, maybe even for a decade of YouTube, actually. And then slowly, when you start doing some interesting things, you start talking about free speech or start going against the grain or being a little politically incorrect, then slowly things start turning on you. You start noticing when you do things that are more controversial, certain videos seem like they really get depressed, or you're on Twitter and, you know, you say something that goes against the progressive orthodoxy of the day and suddenly you get 3 retweets instead of, you know, 300 retweets or whatever it might be.
I'm Marissa Streit. I'm the CEO of PragerU. In 2011, I was hired to build PragerU. The idea was to create a media educational company on the internet. And so YouTube was the perfect destination for it. Suddenly, they changed their community guidelines. They put notifications on our content. They start editorializing our content, making comments that our content is not accurate or inappropriate. That wasn't there in the beginning. We haven't changed. They changed on us.
You know, we wanted to be like a glass of water. We wanted to be that transparent container that just lets you see straight through to the content. Back then, it really wasn't political. That did start to change.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, so what you just heard was part of a short documentary. It was just released, called Restricted. And we found it as a show team here really enlightening. I'll play a few more clips for you throughout the segment. And I think it's important that you hear what these free thinkers have to say. I was sharing with you before the break that yesterday a major conservative group called the American Principles Project had been kicked off of YouTube. And again, this is started by one of the clearest thinkers I know, Professor Robert George from Princeton. And they're self-described as a lobbying group for the family. We need them, right? They do a great work. They're the only national pro-family organization engaging directly in campaigns and elections, the only one. And all of a sudden, they have now been kicked off of YouTube. That makes them targets, right? Why? Because, they're defending family, right? Maggie, open your mic. You have to share with everyone what you just told me in my headset here. Maggie just went to their website. What happened, Mag?
I was just looking up the website, American Principle Project, yep. .org, and it was taking me to a website, a page that said this site is not secure. Now I just did it again, and it finally went to the website. But the first five times I tried, it went to a not secure.
So people are having trouble getting there then is what you're finding if you try to get there. And that will drive somebody away if they feel that the APP is not a secure or safe site. I mean, that would drive me away. I won't go to a site that I get a warning like that.
Right.
They're not alone, as I was saying, too. PragerU, started by Dennis Prager, has sued big tech for censorship. And they just put together a 20-minute documentary about the ways that big tech is going after all kinds of people who dare to question the prevailing orthodoxy of our day. I mean, people like J.P. Sears, who's a comedian, right? He's a YouTube personality, and he skewers a lot of the hypocrisy on the left. They went after him. They even took down an entire application. Remember Parler? Parler was allowing free speech on their platform, just like big tech companies used to do when they began. That's no longer the case. So, here to talk about this, give us some perspective on what's unfolding, to give us some perspective, is the Director of Government Affairs for the American Principles Project, John Schweppe. And I hope you'll check them out. AmericanPrinciplesProject.org, go and check them out. He's been looking into this phenomenon of big tech censorship, and he's got a lot to say. Good to have you with me today, John. Good afternoon. Hey, John, are you with me? Maggie, can you open his mic? Hi, John.
Hey, do you hear me?
I can now. Yes, sir. Good afternoon.
All right. Hey, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I am delighted to have you here. We're going to play some clips coming up throughout the conversation here. I'd love your take on that. But give me your sense. What was the response at the American Principles Project? Why did YouTube kick you guys off? I mean, what's the bottom line here? Tell me what's going on and whether or not you're alone.
Well, I think, with all of these cases of big tech censorship, we're always asked to believe in these strange coincidences, right?
Well,
that, it's just today of all days they removed us. And so, it is noteworthy. We just announced last week our super PAC was engaging in the Virginia governor's race, going after Terry McAuliffe. And I'm not sure how closely you guys are following that race, but it's tremendously close. And, we're doing a six-figure spend, so it's going to be pretty significant. We should have an impact. And, Friday, Terry McAuliffe's campaign blasted their email list, calling us a shadowy, dark money, right-wing group, blah, 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 blah. Fast forward to Monday morning. So it's, our holiday. We're supposed to be enjoying it. I was hanging out with my kids, getting ready for, some baseball. And all of a sudden, we get this email from Google, from YouTube, saying that our channel had been shut down due to severe community guidelines violations. Now, we are, we've never uploaded anything questionable. We've never even had a strike on our account before. So this was kind of, bemusing to us. And for 36 hours, actually, Google did not get back to us. We finally heard from them this afternoon. Now our channel, after being pressured by Republican lawmakers and influencers on social media, now our channel is back up. But they did remove several videos. So, this is kind of what we've gotten used to. This is now the fourth time APP has been censored by social media giants. Always related to the elections we're involved in. And, here we go again, I guess.
Well, that raises questions for me. I mean, I wonder about the relationship between big tech and big government. And we saw the influence that they had when it came to Hunter Biden, when it came to the elections and, the algorithms that were written either to mute information or to put other searches to the top of the list, depending on what party you were, what the message was. Let me play a little bit of audio for you here, and I want your take on this. And it addresses that issue. This clip's a few minutes longer than the last one. But hang in there. I think it's well worth a listen. And it looks into this relationship between big tech and big government.
I'm Rachel Bovard, the Senior Director of Policy at the Conservative Partnership Institute. It wasn't really till 2013 that I started taking an interest in big tech. And that was after Edward Snowden revealed that all of the big tech companies had willingly thrown open their back doors to the CIA, the NSA, to track everyday Americans, to share our photos with them, our emails, our videos, even voice recordings. And I thought, this doesn't seem very kosher, so what else are they up to? All of these industry titans can demonetize these guys with the flick of a wrist. They've completely wiped out someone's livelihood. They can decide now who can make money on their platforms. And in many cases, you know, that's how someone feeds their family. So the power these companies have to decide who can access the marketplace, who can access the guts of capitalism, that is now in the hands of Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Sundar Pichai, and Jack Dorsey. And that is terrifying for a lot of small content creators.
I'm Amy Peikoff, Chief Policy Officer at Parler. The goal with Parler was to go out and compete instead of complaining about the problems with the competitors. And then second, to do that while respecting user privacy. On Parler, the users are not the commodity. You know, in terms of what was making the difference such that they were allowing us to exist, coexist peacefully before and then not later, I think it's because we became a serious threat.
The phrase build your own is one that's always hurled at people who are unhappy with the content moderation. Hey, if you don't like Google, you should just build your own Google.
At Parler, we made our own platform. When we saw first Amazon and then Apple and then vendor after vendor leave. So if you can imagine that, you know, you're playing whack-a-mole and then suddenly here and there you're being given a new bout of whiplash. That was what life was like.
That was a massive escalation because it's one thing when you just, you know, take out one person. So Alex Jones gets booted from Facebook or YouTube. But when they took out Parler, this was, in essence, competition to Twitter. It was competition to big tech. They had 21 million users and they blew up the servers. I mean, it's really that simple. They went to Amazon and they said, end this company. And really that was sort of a mafia tactic.
I think they know that if people are given a viable platform, a successful platform that is a competitor that offers more ability to decide for yourself what you want in your feed and that you know you're not being manipulated, you know that you are not having your data mined, you are not the commodity, that competitor now becomes very dangerous. And I think that's one of the reasons that they wanted to shut us down.
So we've moved way beyond not being able to post on Facebook or send a tweet. And we've really moved into a phase where a handful of companies are deciding who can participate in public life. These handful of companies very much control the avenues to public life. You don't hold views they agree with, they can deplatform you not just from their platforms, but from participating in greater society. When we talk about the free market, you know, we want it to work. We want competitors to arise and out-innovate the big guys, and that's the free market we all know and love. Antitrust enforcement exists to make sure that the little innovator is actually allowed to compete on the merits with the big guy, and the big guy can't just stamp him out of existence. Antitrust is not regulation. Antitrust is law enforcement. So I think people often conflate it with regulation, but again, it is illegal in this country to be a predatory monopoly because of antitrust law, and antitrust enforcement is required when people aren't playing fair. And so this is the way that we protect our free market, and it's incumbent upon our enforcers to make sure the market exists and has integrity for these little guys as well as the big guys.
How do you get to that point, though? I mean, has it gone too far? I'm joined today by the Director of Government Affairs for the American Principles Project. John Schweppe is here with me. And let me pick it up on that point with you. You heard the audio. You heard the case they made. I think it's pretty clear. Is there a collusion going on that we're not aware of where big tech is doing the bidding of some government entities and you know, doesn't want certain viewpoints heard, and as a result can shut down organizations and even stop people from doing business. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think there's two possibilities here. Number one is the collusion narrative you brought up, that these companies are actively working with Democrat elected officials, with candidates to swing the election, to do as much as they possibly can, like suppressing the Hunter Biden story that the New York Post uncovered a few weeks before the election. But, you know, there's a second narrative that I think is pretty compelling, too, which is that, the companies almost feel compelled to do this stuff because Democrats are the only party willing to punish them for not going along with them, right? Like the Republican Party for a long time has historically had a hands-off approach. We believe in small government. We don't want to touch these companies at all or regulate them. And the Democrats are heavy-handed. And their approach to this has been these companies need to take off all the misinformation, what they deem to be misinformation, to censor everything. And, you know, I think the companies are reacting to the party that's actually willing to exert power. And up to this point, I think we're seeing a change there, but up to this point, Republicans have not been that party. And so they're kind of the cheap date here.
That's really a great point. I never thought of it like that. If you want to join the conversation, you want to get in, sound off, maybe you've been censored, maybe you're frustrated by it all, maybe you got a question or a comment, let me open the phones for you. It's 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. So what do you do then at that particular point? I mean, a lot of people have created alternative platforms. That's awful hard to get to the size of a Facebook or a Twitter. And what does one party do versus the other? I mean, the Republicans, are they beginning to wake up to this now? And your thoughts on those two points?
Well, the problem with the competition angle is that, you know, social media is unique in that, you know, it relies on network effects. Basically, people only want to go to the social media sites where all the people are. Right. And so you kind of have a problem with these smaller sites where, you know, people aren't necessarily willing to go there until a certain point. And as we saw with Parler, as was mentioned in the clips you played, Parler was finally starting to reach that point of critical mass where they could have actually been a competitor to Facebook. And boom, they flipped the switch. They all, you know, used their concentrated power to shut them down and destroy them. And effectively, that's what they did. I know Parler still exists, but it hasn't reached critical mass like it was about to. So, you know, the problem is obvious that there's anti-competitive behavior taking place, that these companies that, you know, might be monopolies in various industries, but they're clearly working together as almost a cartel to suppress any sort of conservative idea or whatever. I think we have to actually take action here. And as Rachel Bovard, who's a dear friend of mine, she was in that clip, I think she put it really eloquently. Antitrust is law enforcement, and we really should be looking at it because it's not legal to shut down a company like Parler using those types of tactics.
No doubt. My guest today, John Schweppe. I've got to take a short break. John, stay with me. When we come back, I want to look at who decides what you see. You know, Google's deciding 90% of what a lot of people see. So where do we draw the line? I'll share a little bit more when we come back, and we'll talk more with John Schweppe. You're more than welcome to get in as we approach just the final moments of the broadcast today. Number for you to get in, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
We go there. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
They're all acting as publishers, not as platforms. If they were just neutral platforms, they would let all the content on there. And then if you broke a law, well, then you got a bigger problem than what the platform is going to do to you. The reason they're acting as publishers is they decide what stuff you're going to see or what stuff you're not going to see, or what Twitter will allow to trend, or what stories they're going to hide, or the litany of other things that they can do to manipulate suggested videos, and whether they de-boost things or de-rank things or shadow ban people. I mean, all of these Orwellian terms that no one had heard of, you know, 3 or 4 years ago that now we basically talk about every day.
When we realized that opposing points of view on YouTube were being censored, we started talking to other content creators. you know, some of them to the right, some of them to the left, all of us realized that we were having a serious problem. We had a serious problem with censorship. And so we decided to sue. Since we filed our lawsuit against YouTube, Google, things actually got worse. I feel like we're being punished. Not only are our videos restricted, now we're actually getting these little editorial pieces that they add on our videos where they mention other opposing views and other websites that people should look at in order to refute the points that we make in our videos. And so what has happened is now Google basically gets to have the cake and eat it too.
It's a privilege that's been, you know, just totally distorted and expanded by the courts to cover all kinds of content removal, all kinds of behavior. And it's really almost now tantamount to an industry subsidy. And so it has allowed those nascent internet companies, Google, Facebook, Twitter, to grow into massive behemoths that you can't really compete with.
What Facebook and Twitter and so on have done is create private squares that are so compelling that we might feel today like it's not possible for us to get our voice out there without them. And, you know, that's why we need to do a good job in giving them feedback. And it's why we need to ensure that the market is free for competition to come along and solve this problem.
They aren't just private companies. They're our news source. They're where we speak. They're where we access the marketplace. All of these things, you know, govern society in it generally, right? So the issue isn't the content moderation itself. If Google did this for 30% of the world, it wouldn't be a question. The fact is, Google filters information for 90% of the world. Whatever Google decides is whatever 90% of the world sees.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that's a lot of power. 90% of what the world sees. Good afternoon. You are listening to the Drew Mariani Show. And that was a very, I think, revealing and compelling piece of audio from the recent free speech documentary called Restricted. I've invited today the Director of Government Affairs for the American Principles Project to walk us through this, to give us his analysis and kind of pull back the veil, if you will, look behind the curtain to see what is really at play here. And you don't even recognize this. Half the time you do your search and you're not thinking about the algorithms or even the agenda that's at work. And John Schweppe's here for perspective. You heard that last audio too, and I'm stunned, not surprised, but when you hear it and you realize that 90% of what the world sees in their searches comes from Google, that is an incredible power. And I don't know, it's a private company. What's the recourse to that? I mean, how do you address that? Do we look to the government to try to create some sort of protocol? I mean, can they even do that? Give me your analysis of Google deciding 90% of what people see, and if there is even a way to change that at all, other than competition.
Well, yeah, no, I think we have to get creative, you know, because the reality is, first of all, I think the most important thing is acknowledging that we should see that as dangerous. That one company, one person, really, one CEO,
right,
can really decide which ideas live or die, which candidates are allowed to run and be competitive or not. It's a really dangerous power to give to one person. It's not democratic at all. And so there is a role here. And I know conservatives are usually pretty weary about using government, but we have a long history in this country of using antitrust when companies get too powerful and have too much influence. To the degree they are here. And this is actually historic. We're talking about, you know, trillion-dollar companies, which is, you know, kind of an insane thing to even think about. So I think antitrust is a good approach. Section 230 reform is interesting. You had some folks talking about that on the clip. This is a immunity from tort liability that's given to these platforms. And, you know, if we made that conditional for the largest platforms on them acting like, you know, common carriers, I think that might be pretty helpful towards preventing a lot of the censorship. And, you know, there's other things, too. I mean, we do have campaign finance law in this country. It's enforced against Republicans, certainly. But, you know, this is an example where a corporation is making, when they censor one Republican candidate and leave up the Democrat, that's an in-kind contribution to that Democrat. And that's actually illegal under campaign finance law. Corporations can't do that. So I think there's lots of options. Republicans just have to find the wherewithal to actually do something, and hopefully Democrats join them down the road because it's important, and we really should care about preserving the public square in this country.
Yeah, if you're just joining me, you might have missed the beginning of our conversation, but I was sharing the story about the American Principles Project. Found they were kicked off of YouTube. And again, great organization. They are they're self-described as a lobbying group for the family. They're the only national pro-family organization engaging directly in campaigns and elections. And to that point of our elections, I'm really curious. If 90% of the searches are handled by Google, and we know what happened on Twitter and Facebook, the type of algorithms that were at play, so that if you search during the election for a particular candidate, certain news would come up that was favorable to one candidate. Negative news would come up for the candidate that they didn't like. Certain information wasn't even present. You do a particular search, let's say for Hunter Biden's laptop or whatever it might be. Unbelievable control there. How much pause does this give you in terms of our democratic republic and how it functions, how the elections could possibly be compromised, or how propaganda can be put forth? I mean, this is a serious, serious problem that is somewhat invisible to most Americans. They don't think about it when they do their search or they get their news feed. How serious of an issue is this, and how concerned are you about elections and information, propaganda, really?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, when I have my conversations with some of my more libertarian friends out here in D.C., many of whom work for big tech-funded think tanks, one of the things I really articulate to them is, look, we have to do this to save democracy, because once the American people stop believing that our elections are legitimate, once they believe that companies are able to arbitrarily determine which candidates, that's not good for our republic. I don't think people are going to stand for that. That's certainly not a very American ideal. So, the way I look at it, politics is where we settle these things, where we, are able to have these transfers of power peacefully and not have dangerous, things that happen seemingly everywhere else happen here. And so it's really important that we preserve the public square. And these companies are actively working to turn this into an authoritarian country. And I think that's really dangerous.
Yeah, and I think it's I think you've brought up a really important point here. And again, I could be totally off on this, but I have never in my life, at least, ever seen a time when the citizens of this country question our electoral process more than they ever have. So many people think that the elections have been rigged and are rigged. In fact, there's a caller on the line here. I don't have time to get to him, but he's saying, and Roy, thank you for your call. He's saying, what's the point of even voting? They're controlling the elections. I don't know if they're going that far, but to that point, where are people when it comes to trust? Because if we don't trust in that process, our republic is doomed.
Yeah, no, I think the American people are justifiably not trusting the situation we're in. We talk about whether the election was influenced or not. And, there's a lot of discussion about ballot integrity and election integrity. And I think that's really important. But, we saw the difference was decided by, I think, 43,000 votes in three states in the presidential election. There's no question in my mind that big tech got Joe Biden elected. I mean, when you look at what Google's capable of doing, when you look at Facebook routinely censoring conservative ads from our group, by the way, as well. There's no question that that was the difference. And so I think that's really bad, because it doesn't feel, again, that's a legal activity. If it's an in-kind contribution, that doesn't feel fair. And I think the American people are not going to take to that. So got to figure this out.
John, thank you. He's director of government affairs at the American Principles Project. Check them out at AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. I'm out of time for the day. I want to thank you for allowing me to be part of your afternoon. I'll be back again tomorrow. Until then, have a great day.